From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio. Welcome to episode 26 of NIH Research Radio, with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. Coming up on this edition, Wally Akinso has a report about the results of a new study that may help improve the diagnosis and treatment of two debilitating childhood mental disorders, pediatric bipolar disorder, and a syndrome called severe mood dysregulation. Then I'll have a few things to say about the importance of clinical research in the ongoing search for new treatments and cures for disease that have plagued mankind for centuries. In other words, I'm not just a spokesperson, I'm also a consumer. But first, Wally talks about the science of addiction. That's next on NIH Research Radio. If you had the key to unlock the secrets of medical science, you'd use it. At the NIH Clinical Center, many of our studies involve healthy volunteers who provide valuable insights in finding new ways to prevent, diagnose, and treat common and rare disorders.
Do you have the key?
Log on to clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116 for more info. The National Institutes of Health is a nonprofit government agency, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. It's a marriage between electronic and print media. The message? Addiction is a disease. Here's a report by Wally Akinso.
The National Institute on Drug Abuse has unveiled its first consumer publication dedicated to explain the science of addiction. The 30-page full-color booklet, Drugs, Brains, and Behavior, The Science of Addiction, explains in layman's terms how science has revolutionized the understanding of drug addiction as a brain disease that affects behavior. Dr. Timothy Condon, NIDA's deputy director, said this new publication will help reduce the stigma attached to addictive disorders.
Well, this booklet explains the scientific research that NIDA has supported over the last 20 or 30 years, and how this research has really revolutionized our understanding of drug addiction, essentially as a brain disease that results in compulsive behavior.
The new publication was introduced during a press briefing for the upcoming HBO documentary called Addiction. Dr. Condon said the timing was fortunate.
This is very fortuitous that it's coming out around the same time as the HBO documentary that NIDA's been a part of. We think this will be a very important adjunct to information for the public, the lay audience, to help them understand the science behind the disease of addiction.
The 90-minute documentary airs Thursday, March 15th. It was produced in partnership with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the National Institute on Drug Abuse and Alcoholism, and NIDA, and will explore many elements of drug and alcohol addiction through the eyes of those who are addicted and the experts working to better understand and treat this disease. If you're interested in a copy of the booklet, visit www.drugabuse.gov. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
We're swiftly approaching the first anniversary of podcasting from the National Institutes of Health. In that period, we've devoted a lot of time to discussing the importance of clinical research, also known as clinical trials. Simply put, a clinical trial is a research study in human volunteers to answer specific health questions. Now, all along, here on the podcast and elsewhere, we've encouraged listeners who want to know more about clinical trials to visit the website, www.clinicaltrials.gov, to get additional information. In a series of public service announcements aired around the nation and here on NIH Research Radio, I've asked the question, if you had the key to unlock the secrets of medical science, would you use it? Well, as it turns out, I am in possession of such a key. 7 years ago, at the age of 45, I was initially diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. That's a condition that occurs when, for unknown reasons, the brain stops producing a chemical known as dopamine. That's a chemical messenger that's similar to adrenaline and affects the brain processes that control movement. Dopamine is vital for performing balanced and controlled movements. A shortage of dopamine can cause a lack of controlled movements, such as those experienced in Parkinson's disease. Recently, I decided to take part in a clinical trial of a procedure designed to study the safety and tolerability of a procedure known as deep brain stimulation in patients in the early stages of Parkinson's disease, or PD, as it's sometimes called. PD has gotten a lot of press lately with the controversy surrounding stem cell research. Although there are some promising areas of research currently being investigated, as of today, there is no cure for Parkinson's. But there are effective treatments for folks like myself who experience the four typical symptoms of PD, namely tremor, stiffness, slowness, and postural instability, or impaired balance and coordination. For most Parkinson's patients, symptoms are controlled to varying degrees with medication, such as a combination of levodopa and carbidopa, known by the brand name Sinemet. Others, including myself, take a newer combination of meds that includes levodopa and carbidopa, and a third compound known as entacapone, which helps the first two drugs work better by allowing more of it to reach the brain. There are other medications as well, but for most PD patients, after extended medical therapy, one reaches the point where several things start to happen. For one, the medications begin to lose their effectiveness. That is, they don't reduce or eliminate the symptoms of PD as well as they once did. Doctors deal with this by adjusting the medications as needed, increasing the dosage or the number of pills taken each day. But Parkinson's is a progressive disease, meaning it never gets better. It only gets worse. And the further a person progresses into Parkinson's, the more potential side effects arise from the medication. One side effect you've heard discussed quite a bit recently is a condition known as dyskinesia. When you see Michael J. Fox on television, for instance, and you see him twist and squirm in his chair, that's not the Parkinson's disease making him do that. It's the levodopa that he's been taking for years to replace the dopamine his brain is no longer producing so he can control his PD symptoms. In cases like this, patients and their doctors find themselves having to make a choice between the uncontrollable muscle movements of dyskinesia and the immobility of Parkinson's disease if left under-medicated. It's a hard choice that I, like all Parkinson's patients, will eventually have to make if a cure is not found. There have been surgical techniques developed over the years. Some of the earlier ones involved surgical destruction of a small part of the brain. Until the late 1990s, this procedure, known as a pallidotomy, was the most common type of PD surgery. But then, thanks in large part to research and funding by the National Institutes of Health, a new surgical technique became available and was approved by the FDA, deep brain stimulation. In this procedure, instead of destroying a small amount of brain tissue, electrodes are placed inside the brain to deliver continuous stimulation to a portion of the brain, blocking the abnormal nerve signals that cause tremor and the other PD symptoms. I had a chance to talk to Dr. Joseph J. Pancrazio, Program Director for Neuroengineering at the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke. He explained how NIH was involved in the development of deep brain stimulation as a treatment for Parkinson's disease.
So NIH has been involved in several different ways. First of all, we supported research that identified the particular neural circuits that are involved in movement. And it provided really the locations where perturbations in the electrical properties of cells would be good candidates as targets for DBS. So a lot of that early work went on in the 80s and 90s before some of the revolutionary work occurred by Professor Benabid in France. What's happening now is that we're supporting work that ranges from through small business innovative research grants to bioengineering research grants that allows us to understand how DBS works, how we might improve clinical application of DBS. The one thing that DBS has in common with real estate is that the three most important things are location, location, location. We're supporting a lot of research for data visualization tools, imaging and mapping to improve surgical targeting of key regions of the brain in DBS.
Dr. Pancrazio briefly explained how deep brain stimulation, or DBS, works to stop the tremor and loosen the rigidity of a patient with movement disorders like Parkinson's disease.
Movement is largely controlled by the basal ganglia, which is a network of interconnected brain cells. A common feature in movement disorders is that there's the manifestation of electrical bursting or seizure-like activity of cells in the basal ganglia. And with DBS, electrical fields modulate the activity of brain cells, neurons, in proximity to the electrode. And these changes then alter network behavior, the behavior of the network that's responsible for the control of movement.
As of today, DBS is only approved by the Food and Drug Administration for treatment of Parkinson's patients whose symptoms aren't adequately controlled by medication. But researchers at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee, have begun a study in patients who haven't reached that point as of yet. People like me, who are still at a relatively early stage of the disease. One of the things the Vanderbilt researchers will try to learn is whether or not early deep brain stimulation can slow the progression of PD. And that's where I come in, that key to unlock the secrets of medical science I spoke of earlier. After discovering this study on the website www.clinicaltrials.gov, I discussed this trial with my neurologist. She said she felt the study raised interesting questions, so I took the next step and contacted Ms. Chandler Gill, a delightful young lady serving as study coordinator at Vanderbilt University. She scheduled me for a meeting with Dr. P. David Charles, the principal investigator with the Vanderbilt University Department of Neurology, and Dr. Peter Conrad, the neurosurgeon who performs the procedure. I also met with Dr. Stuart Finder, a bioethicist at Vanderbilt, who was positively relentless in his determination that I be acutely aware of the potential risks of the procedure, and, if I decided to sign the consent form, I was making the right decisions for reasons that were right for me. After a mandatory 72-hour waiting period, I signed the consent forms. So, here's what happens next. Sometime in March, I'll return to the Clinical Research Center at Vanderbilt University for an MRI and CT of my brain, as well as neurological and psych testing. Assuming all goes well after that, I'll be asked to keep an hour-by-hour diary of my PD symptoms during my waking hours for a period of 2 weeks. Then I'll return to Vanderbilt to stay in the clinical center for 8 days without medication so the researchers can get a good baseline reading of just where I am in the progression of my disease. I'll be videotaped for future reference. Then I will either be one of the 50% randomized to have the surgery, or I'll be assigned to the control group, in which case I'll continue on my medication and be compared to the folks who did have the surgery. If I have the surgery, then my involvement with the study will end in 4 years, during which I'll visit the clinical center at Vanderbilt twice each year for 8-day periods. If I'm in the control group, my involvement ends in 2 years, not 4, but I will also be a guest of the Clinical Research Center at Vanderbilt twice a year for an 8-day stretch each visit. So, what's the point of my sharing this very personal information with an attentive, but otherwise impersonal, podcast audience? Well, if it's one of our goals here at NIH to convey to the public the importance of clinical research in the ongoing search for new cures and new treatments, what better way than to share the step-by-step experiences of a patient in a clinical trial setting? And who better than the host of the podcast? Over the next weeks and months, I'll introduce you to the folks conducting the research at Vanderbilt University. We'll talk to researchers here at the National Institutes of Health, especially in the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, who were instrumental in the research and development of the procedure and devices used in deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's disease. And I'll share the experience of staying at a clinical research center, the screening tests, and, if so randomized, the surgery itself. I have no idea sitting here on this February afternoon in 2007 how this is all going to end up, but it should be an interesting journey, and I hope you'll stay tuned. Of course, for more information about the many and various clinical trials performed by and supported by the National Institutes of Health, visit the website www.clinicaltrials.gov, because if you had the key to unlock the secrets of medical science, you'd use it, wouldn't you? When we come back, Wally has a report about a study that could improve diagnosis of two debilitating childhood mental disorders. That's next on NIH Research Radio. Aristotle had this problem, so did Thomas Jefferson, and they went on to do great things. If you stutter, you could do something great too by participating in a National Institutes of Health stuttering study. Participants will be compensated, travel assistance is available, and all study-related tests are provided at no cost. Call 866-999-5553 or visit clinicaltrials.gov. Do something great. The NIH is a nonprofit government agency of the Department of Health and Human Services. As is true with any medical or psychological disorder, you have to know what condition you're treating before you treat it. Wally Akinso has this report.
Results of a new study may help improve the diagnosis and treatment of two debilitating childhood mental disorders, pediatric bipolar disorder, and a syndrome called severe mood dysregulation, better known by the acronym SMD. In the study conducted by the National Institute of Mental Health, researchers found a very different pattern in children with SMD. Compared with children who had bipolar disorder when the brain's electrical signals were measured during mild, frustrating situations. Dr. Ellen Liebenluft, chief of the Unit on Bipolar Spectrum Disorders in the Emotion and Development Branch of the NIH Mood and Anxiety Disorders Research Program, said the results indicate that different brain mechanisms may lead to irritability in children with SMD, suggesting that they may have an illness other than bipolar disorder and may require different treatments.
The treatment might differ depending on whether or not these children have SMD or they have bipolar disorder.
The classic definition of bipolar disorder includes extreme sustained mood swings that range from over excited, elated moods, and irritability to depression. In contrast, children with SMD are extremely irritable and hyperactive, but do not have clear-cut manic episodes. Dr. Liebenluft said the researchers could observe the brain's electrical signals that occur during frustration as children with either disorder perform simple tasks.
The main significance of these results is that when we think about diagnosing psychiatric illnesses, we have to look not just at how children are behaving and how they say they're feeling. That's all very important. But in addition, we also have to be looking at what's going on inside their brains. And that eventually being able to do so with things like EEG and neuroimaging techniques like functional MRI, the fact that we can now see the brain at work means that ultimately we'll be able to do a much better job of diagnosing both children and adults.
Dr. Liebenluft said the study shows that clinicians someday could use biological measurements such as EEGs to help psychiatric diagnosis in combination with clinical symptoms. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
And with that, we come to the end of this episode of NIH Research Radio. Please join us again on Friday, March 9th, when episode 27 of NIH Research Radio will be available for download. These stories are also available on the NIH Radio News Service website, www.nih.gov/news/radio. Our daily 60-second feature, NIH Health Matters, is heard on nearly 1,000 radio stations nationwide, as well as on XM Satellite Radio and on the HealthStar Radio Network. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact me. The info is right there on the podcast webpage. If we use your comment, we'll send you something nice from the NIH gift shop. That email address is ws159h. at nih.gov. Once again, our email address is ws159h at nih.gov. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison, and the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.